So it's just
the three of us. Yeah, good morning. Yeah, any questions? So, I mean, what we did the last 2 weeks almost is to look through the various cases of the Olin-Scott theorem. I mean, this is not something necessary to really memorize. It's something to be aware of. Okay, that theorem exists. There is this classification, and it that's where these groups fall in. And one application of this is to say, can we describe the maximal subgroups of the alternate or of the symmetric groups? They are prominent groups. Can we say what are the maximal subgroups? And basically, so what I will do is I will describe this for the symmetric groups. So if I think this is 5 was Olin-Scott in some way, this would be an error of 6. These are, well, consequences of Olin-Scott in relations. Okay, I want to look at maximal subgroups of symmetric groups and state this as a theorem. This theorem, the way I'll state it, is for symmetric groups. There is a very similar one for alternating groups. It's a little bit more complicated, but basically what you often have, I mean, if you have the symmetric group Sn, you have the alternating group An, and now you look at a maximal subgroup. If you take a maximal subgroup M here, which does not contain, okay, An is clearly one of the maximal ones. Okay, that's not very surprising. If you take a maximal subgroup which does not contain An, together they have to generate the symmetric group because it's maximal and An will contain something which is not in there. Okay, and they will intersect somewhere. Okay, and often, because these two groups are so close together and this is normal in there, not always, but very often this intersection is also then maximal in An. So if this is maximal, then this is often maximal. But it doesn't have to be. I mean, there are cases where this is not the case. What also can happen is that An might have maximal subgroups which do not arise as an intersection. So, do not arise as intersection. So, for example, there is a simple group of order 7920, the Mathieu group M11. M11, which is a subgroup, well, actually not just of S11, but of A11. So this is a group on permutation group on 11 points. It has order 7920 and it's simple non-abelian. It arises from S automorphisms of certain combinatorial structures, for example, these signs. This group is contained in A11, but there isn't a corresponding group in S11 where it would be the intersection. So that can also happen. So the situation, it's not exactly, there can be more happening, but in the broad picture, the what I drew in blue is roughly what is happening. So the spirit of this theorem also holds for the alternating groups. It's just easier to state for symmetric groups. Okay, let M be a subgroup of Sn, and I want this to be a maximal subgroup. Then M is one of the following. Well, and one of is, I should say, is up to permutation isomorphism, so up to numbering the points. Okay.
So is it inner automorphisms then?
Yeah. I mean, these would be inner isomorphisms of the symmetric group. This is just relabeling the points, and this is basically just because in some cases you might say, oh, this is a particular action. So one of them is the alternating group AN. Okay. This has index 2, index is prime, that clearly must be maximal. Well, and now, and that is basically how you prove this. So, you now say, let's assume we have a maximal subgroup. That maximal subgroup could be intransitive. So if it is intransitive, it would have to lie in SA cross SB, where A plus B is equal to N, and we have that without loss of generality, A is strictly smaller than B. Okay, so what I'm doing here is I'm grouping the orbits together in some way that I have just a partition into two, and we have seen if a group is intransitive, it lies in such a direct product. It's just, that's where the permutation isomorphism comes in. If one of the orbits is 1, 3, and 7, and I have an S3, I normally would have it on 1, 2, 3. That's why there is the labeling of points. Okay, so we know that it lies in there. That does not by default show that this is indeed maximal. But you've shown that in one of the homework problems. Right? And the way you've shown it is actually to say this subgroup can be considered as a particular stabilizer. It's a stabilizer of A sets. And so the action on the cosets is the action on A sets. And what we will see is that basically most of these other classes also can be considered as stabilizers of something combinatorial. And that's how one could prove that many of them are also maximal. Okay. Right. Why do I say A is strictly smaller than B? If A and B are equal, then I can also allow swapping the two sets. And that is slightly larger. And then I get a ring product which is slightly larger. So that's why this condition comes. I mean, if I say if it is maximal, it must be one of the following. That's not really a condition. If I leave this away, it still would hold for the theorem, just if that is really a condition for maximality. Otherwise, it's not maximal. Okay. The next class is, okay, if the group is transitive, it could be imprimitive, and we have seen if it is imprimitive, it embeds into a Reith product. The largest possible Reith product is a Reith product of symmetric groups, so we could have SL wreathed SM with L times M is equal to N. And yeah, I mentioned if A and B are the same, this actually lies in here. Okay. These wreath products are stabilizers of partitions. So to show that this is maximal, I would have to take a look at the action not on sets, but the action on partitions. And I can do a proof very similar to the proof you've done in the homework. It just gets far more messy because you have one further inclusion property. You don't have sets, you have sets of sets, but you can show that is maximal. Okay, right. And otherwise, the group must be primitive. Okay, so if it is primitive, there is the Onen-Scott theorem, and we know it must lie in one of these classes. And these classes are basically described by maximal subgroups in these classes. Okay, so we could, for example, have a primitive group with solvable socle. Then we have seen this must be of affine type, so it must lie in AGL, MP with N is equal to P to the M. Okay, here to show that this often is maximal is a bit more, but there the structure is a little bit more complicated, because you basically would need to say, oh, I can define a linear structure on the points, and this linear structure is preserved. So we could have this. We could have groups which are almost simple. And that is something where we never can reduce directly there. Basically, we need to go to the classification of the finite simple group. That would fall in this class, M11, for example. And then we basically had two other constructions. We had the wreath product in product action, and we had the diagonal action. Okay. The product action we have split up in different cases.
Is he sick? Or?
No, runny nose.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Bathroom isn't far.
That's true.
So we had split off the product action in multiple cases, depending of what type the first factor was. Well, if you want maximal subgroups, we could just say it's a product action of two permutation groups, and that will always lie in the product action of the symmetric groups. So we don't need to split up the cases. So we would have SA wreath SB in product action. Action for N is equal to A to the B. Right? We are looking at a B-dimensional structure where in each dimension we have 8 points, so N is A to the B. Okay? And finally, we could have the diagonal action. We could have that the group that we can take the maximal diagonal group, so we take A copies of a simple group, and then we take the maximum we can put on it, top of it, a symmetric group which switches the components, and a diagonal outer automorphisms where we have T simple and we have N is equal to T to the A minus 1, where we take the diagonal action. And again, that is maximal why can't it be larger? Well, essentially in rare cases it can. So there are, this theorem, as I wrote it down, is not saying all of these subgroups always are maximal. Mm-hmm. There generically are, but what can happen in particular situations that some maximal subgroup happens to lie in another class. That happens sometimes. And there is a paper by Liebeck, Prager, and Saxel where they actually go through the work and explicitly give the exceptions that one can essentially write down lists. And they also do this for the alternating groups. So in the case of the alternating groups, what you get, basically you intersect these with alternating groups, and then you would get here, you would get a subdirect product because the parity in both components needs to be the same, and so on. Yeah, so that is a classification of the maximal subgroups of the symmetric group. And if you, yeah, this class is in some way the complicated one. There potentially a lot could happen. Again, if you simply look at the conditions, you have this for every degree, you have this for every degree, you have this if the degree is not prime, you have this case potentially for every degree, and you could even say that the alternating group AN would fit into this class. And the other three cases can only happen under rather restrictive conditions on the degrees. Basically, the degrees need to be proper powers. So that happens actually rather rarely. There is the one class I did not write down is the twisted wreath product. And there one can show that the twisted wreath product class never will be maximal in the full symmetric group. That requires a little bit more analysis of how they actually look, but there you can show generically, I think they always lie in a product action. Okay. Right. So that is the classification of maximal subgroups of the symmetric. The other thing I want to do today before spring break is to look at a related statement, and that goes under the name of Aschbacher's theorem. So this is named after Michael Aschbacher, who stated this first in a paper in, I think, around 84. 1984. It is a useful result. It is a result which doesn't... There isn't really a nice write-up of a proof. I mean, Aschbacher published a proof, and that paper is one of the worst papers I've ever seen. Basically, that paper, there are initially 8 sections, and these sections are all written as, oh, here are some facts I happen to know. Completely unconnected. oh, you can do this, and then that theorem holds, and that, okay, and then he goes to the next section to a completely different topic, and then in the end comes a proof where he's using some of these statements he's stated before, and it's not clear, does he really need all of them? And but it is a very useful result. So, yeah, thanks. Aschbacher's theorem, this is in some way an analog for linear groups. And again, this, you can phrase it either as a statement as the Onan's, like the Onan-Scott theorem, if you have, well, there the question is, Onan-Scott says, if the group is primitive, because the imprimitive and intransitive case in some way are just two of them. So typically this is formulated more in the language of if it is a maximal subgroup, because actually the situation is a little bit more complicated and there isn't just a primitive-imprimitive dichotomy. So this describes the maximal subgroups of the linear, of the general linear group. Of G, L, N, Q. Okay. And the way to look at this classification is to, if you go back here, what is happening in the classification? Basically, all the maximal subgroups can be considered, apart from A, well, A, and even there you can say it's a parity of the permutations, apart from this class, everything else you can consider as preserving a certain combinatorial structure. So here, this is preserving the partition of N points into a set of A points and a set of B points. This is preserving a partition, not as here the partition, we want to keep the cells fixed. Here in the partition, we allow the cells to be permuted, and that gets fixed. Here we have not just a partition, but we basically have a Cartesian product structure, which is preserved, that we can parameterize the points by an N tuple, by a B tuple, and the B tuple structure might be permuted amongst each other, but the B tuple structure otherwise is preserved. Okay, these two cases are a little bit more complicated to say what it exactly is, but what this theorem is saying is, if we have a maximal subgroup of the symmetric group, either it preserves something combinatorial, or it is almost simple. And that is, in some way, the statement of Aschbacher's theorem. So, what this theorem is saying in its first approximation is a maximal subgroup of GLM Q, and, well, actually, you might want, instead of GL, you might want to say you just want SLNQ, because otherwise you always, well, you have at least potentially, unless the GCD is one, that SL is strictly smaller than GL. No, sorry, SL is always strictly smaller than GL. Okay. Right, and the other thing which he's doing, if you look back at this picture which I had here on the board before, we have GL, in GL we have SL, and we have the center of GL, and we have the center of SL. and they together generate something, and they intersect somewhere. Okay. So, what he is really interested is the maximal subgroups which correspond to this bit here, which are in SL and contain the center of SL. So he wants maximal subgroups of PSL. He does not want to look at maximal subgroups which do not contain the center. Okay. Or which would intersect somewhere with the center. Why that? Well, if you had a maximal subgroup which would, let's for simplicity say it would not contain the center, and the case of intersecting with the center is working rather similarly. So assume if we had that is something either if you can squeeze it aside or leave some space here. If there was a maximal subgroup of SL which intersects trivially with the center, then what situation would we have? We would have SL, we would have the center, we would have that maximal subgroup, they would intersect trivially, and then with the same argument as before, because this is not contained there, they would generate this. The center is normal. Then we actually would have this, because this is normal, it's a semi-direct product, because this is actually central, it commutes with everything, so that makes this also normal. Then SL would be a direct product. Mm. Then SL is isomorphic to a direct product of M with the center of SL, and M itself would be isomorphic to PSL, because it would be isomorphic to this vector group. Okay. So in that case, yes, that can happen in particular cases. There are situations where this can happen, and we had seen this with the GCD of Q minus 1 and N. So basically, you just need this GCD to be 1. And then something like this will happen. And that is really not that interesting a structure. You can describe exactly what is happening, and you can basically then write this group down directly with by multiplying with suitable scalar matrices. Okay, so he wants maximal subgroups of SL which containing the center of SL. So that's the groups where he's interested with. Okay, and in first approximation, what his theorem is basically saying is either preserves a geometric structure, well, or not. Okay, then the theorem wouldn't be particularly strong. So what he's really saying, the or not case can only happen if the group is almost simple. Or is almost simple. So this is exactly the same situation as with the symmetric group. We have, it's just what with the symmetric group is combinatorial structure, some subsets. With a general linear group becomes something where you have the linear structure and therefore can even make it some geometric structure. So it is, in that sense, really, in a meta sense, it's the same theorem. Of course, the proof is completely different, needs to be proven separately. And that is really, I mean, in that sense, it might look almost trivial that it holds. No, but this that the group otherwise must be almost simple. That is really a rather strong statement. That it says no, otherwise nothing can happen. So, what are these different geometric structures which can be preserved? And the way this statement, this theorem then is often stated, is that these geometric structures are lying in particular classes which are called C1 up to C8, and almost simple is the class C9. And you could, instead of numbers, you could give them names. So, what I want to do is to give you, I mean, I certainly don't even want to attempt doing anything like a proof or so. I just want to give you a bit an idea what these geometric structures can be. And in some way, really, that is also, again, now a classification. How do matrix groups look like? If you have a group, a matrix group, well, either it's almost simple or it will fall in one of these categories, and you can use this in the same way as you can use the Onen-Scott theorem to classify primitive groups. You can use this to classify matrix groups. In particular, there is, and that is something which I skipped so far. I said, oh, you can write down a list, well, with of primitive groups. There is the affine case, where we have where we need irreducible subgroups of GL. How can we get these irreducible subgroups of GL? Well, we can get them with Aschbacher's theorem. So, and that is indeed what is done there. So, So I now want to describe these geometric classes. Okay, and to describe them, to describe the geometric structure, it makes sense to talk about the vector space. So the geometric, there is obviously a vector space. There is FQ to the N. FQ to the N. The natural vector space where it acts on. And that's where I want these geometric structures to live. Okay. And I will call this vector space M, M for module. And what I mean by this is I don't just want the vector space itself, but I want the vector space as acted on by the group. So it's the, well, the fancy thing is you go into a different category. What I'm basically just doing is I'm, so as module for the maximal subgroup G of SL. Okay, what do I mean by S module? This is just saying I have the same set of elements, I have the same arithmetic, but what I allow as substructures is different. Namely, I only allow substructures which are invariant under the action of this group, which are preserved by the action of the group.
So we're thinking of them as a G module and then
Yes. And I just didn't want to do the formal definition of G module because technically module means that you have a ring acting, so I need to do this properly, you actually need to make a ring out of the group, which is called the group ring. You do a formal vector space over the group. The group as basis. So the only substructures structure
allowed are invariant under G. And what I can do is, the easiest way to describe the classes is actually to say, I can now not I decompose the group, but I decompose this module. I say this module has a particular structure. And in some way, yes, I could have done this here. I could have said the points have a particular structure. Or I could say here, the group is a subgroup of this kind of wreath product or this kind of product in a particular action. But that's a little bit more complicated to write down. Okay. So, class 1 is M is reducible. Okay. We had this when I defined irreducible. Reducible is the opposite case. There exists a subspace which is invariant under the group. And what does this mean for the group? For the group, it means that all the matrices must have some structure, if I choose my basis correctly, which is just conjugation, that some subspace is kept invariant. Well, if I act on row vectors, for example, it would have this structure. If you act on column vectors, you would have the transpose. So all matrices would have this structure. Okay. And that is the analog of the intransitive case for permutation groups. Okay. That can happen. And what is the largest subgroup? The largest subgroup, the corresponding maximal subgroup, basically would be the stabilizer of a subspace. And you want the subspace, and then what is the structure of this group? You can have a full GL here, you can have a full GL here, and you can have arbitrary entries here. You take all the matrices of this form with non-zero or with determinant 1. That's the group. And then this set, actually, this becomes, you can look at these blocks of the matrices as a vector space where this group and this group, they act on, one acts on the rows, one acts on the columns. And that is the structure of this group. Okay.
So you said that the top right, you said we're looking at, we can think of it as the stabilizer of the subspace?
Yes.
Well, if it's an invariant under G, then isn't that like it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, sorry. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, then I can choose a base, and now it's where I said before, up to permutation isomorphism. Yes, I can choose a basis such that the matrices will look like this. And yes, to describe it, it's much easier to describe, to talk about the module, but I think it's still helpful to see what does it mean for the group. It's just, I'm not giving you exactly construction what this group is. This is a little bit more complicated to construct, because in SL actually you need to allow that you can have determinant 1, even though this block and this block both have not determinant 1. So you actually get a subdirect product of GL, of this GL with this GL, where they are grouped together, that the determinants are reciprocal. Okay. So that's the first class. Now, the next case we had for permutation groups was imprimitive. Imprimitive meant I'm not stabilizing a set, but I'm stabilizing a partition. So there are some sets which can be moved around, but they can be moved around only to some of the other ones, and they somehow partition this. So what would be the analog here? The analog here would be that. So subsets, stabilizer subset here corresponded to a subspace. So what I could have is I could have a set of subspaces which form a direct sum. So M is as a vector space that I have some subspaces V1, direct sum V2, direct sum and so forth, direct sum VK. So these are subspaces, they are not submodules, because if they were submodules, I would be reducible. So these are subspaces, but the action of G can only permute these subspaces amongst each other. And this is basically the case of the embedding into wreath products in the matrix world. That's the induced representation. So how does my group G look like? G would be a subgroup of the general linear group of V1. So I can do the full general linear group on each of these subspaces. And I can have a wreath as K. I can permute these subspaces amongst each other in any arbitrary way, but I can never map a subspace to somehow completely skew to a mix, into a mix of some of the other subspaces. What in general, of course, I can do.
So these VIs are all same dimension?
They must therefore all be of the same dimension, yes. And therefore this can only happen if the total dimension is, if this the dimension of V1 divides the dimension of M. Yes. It just, it can happen in any case, in any dimension, because the dimension of V1 could be 1. Right. Okay, so what now can happen in the case of matrix groups is that we will have, so these are in some way analogs of the intransitive and the imprimitive case. We have two other analogs of the intransitive and the imprimitive case. And they correspond to a different kind of decomposition. So here our decomposition of the vector space is as a direct sum of subspaces. Here, one of the subspaces is kept fixed. Here, at least the collection of subspaces is kept fixed. Okay. So there is a different way how one can describe how these how one can decompose a subspace, and that is as a tensor product. Okay, what is a tensor product? For what we need here, we can actually find this very easily, because we have finite dimensional spaces and we don't really need the generic we don't need the universality property. So we have the definition: if A and B are F vector spaces with bases, and the definition I will give you for the tensor product is a definition as a vector space with a basis. If they're finite dimensional, we can write down finite basis. This is a perfectly good definition. It's not the most general one needs. If you want to go into ring theory, module theory, but for what we are doing here, that's perfectly fine. So we have, for A, we have a basis A1 up to AN, and and we have a basis B1 up to Bm, then the tensor product A tensor B is an F vector space with a basis which is labeled by products of these vectors, with a basis labeled with formal products AI tensor BJ. Okay, so what we do is basically, so it's a vector space of dimension n times m. And if we do this, yes, we can label the basis vectors in this way just by the Cartesian product of basis vectors there. Okay. So that in itself is not very interesting. Yes, you know you can have vector spaces over a field in any arbitrary dimension, and you can use whatever model you like for describing, for example, row spaces or column spaces. Okay. So the whole reason to bother with Reith products, with tensor products, is basically because of some connection to the original spaces. Okay, and there are two kinds of connections which are useful. The one connection is, and that's what ring theory or sometimes an abstract algebra course or people who come from commutative algebra look at. They look at embedding, having a map from A and from B into this, to this tensor product. There is an obvious way how you can map from the Cartesian product of the vector spaces. So you take the Cartesian product of the vector space and you basically say, I want to map the pair of the basis vector AI, BJ, I want to map this to here. And then one can show that the tensor product in some way is a universal structure for multilinear maps, maps which are linear in each component. Okay, and that's what you might have seen before. What I care, the reason I care about tensor products here is a little bit different, because I want to assume that A and B are modules for the same group. So, if A and B are G modules, then A tensor B is also a G module. So if I have a group acting on two vector spaces, okay, I want to make a new vector space where the group also acts on. And one way I can do is the situation I have here. I can take the direct sum of the vector spaces. So basically, if I'm in the matrix world, I just take two matrices and I stick them together separately, like intransitive groups. So that is something which can happen, and that would be one vector space. The tensor product is a different vector space, one with a more complicated structure, where I'm combining the actions of these groups. Namely, how do I want this action to be? It's sufficient if I describe what happens with basis vectors. Right? Because if I know what happens on a basis, I know what happens on arbitrary vectors. And essentially what I'm doing is I'm taking the action on A and B and extend it to this in the only possible way to make it linear. So if the image of the basis vector AI under an element G is the sum over Cij a J, right? I can write the image as a linear combination of the basis vectors, and the image of B, well, let's call it J then, let's call it BK. BK under G would be the sum under DKL BL. Right, so I'm just saying, I write down the images. These are the coefficients. If I want the action as a matrix, these are just the coefficients which are written in the matrices. So these formulas are just saying I want to describe the action by matrices, and that's just proper with indices, and I don't need to draw a picture with dot, dot, dot. So then let the image of the formal basis vector AI tensor BK, right? So this is just this tensor product between the basis vectors, this is just making it a label. I have these n times m many basis vectors, and I once chose these basis vectors and gave them such labels. Okay. And I want this image to be, well, the image of this under G, well, I want to basically have these two actions here together. So what do? I take the sum. Here I have a sum over J, here I have a sum over L. So I'm taking the sum over J and L, and I'm taking CIJ DKL, and I'm taking AJ tensor BL. And again, this means the basis vector with this label. Okay. And there is nothing, I mean, in this definition, it's basically just writing the things down and not making a mistake when copying an index. There is nothing miraculous in here.
Isn't that essentially just looking at the G, like under the Cartesian thing? So it goes, you know, the tensor product goes to tensor with A,
yeah.
I, G, and then
yeah.
pull it all up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what I've done now here is basically, if I consider these pairs as basis vectors for this tensor product space, I'm writing again matrix coefficients. So how does this matrix look like? And it depends a bit in which order, how you arrange these basis vectors. You have two components. You need to decide which way around, whether you go to the rectangle row by row or column by column. But basically, this will be a matrix. So if this will be a big matrix where I'm taking C11, and now I'm taking the matrix of all the D's. D11, D12 up to D1, DX on B, so I have D1M. Here I have DM1 up to DMM. Okay, and now I'm taking C12 times the same matrix of the D's, and so forth. Here I'm getting C21 times the matrix of the D's. And this construction actually is called the Kronecker product of matrices.
So this is a matrix with a matrix in it, essentially? Well,
with matrix, yeah, with multiple, I mean, and of course I'm unwrapping the inner matrix, yes. I have this structure that I put this matrix multiple times in there, and I scale it with the different entries here. Okay, and by going to this back here, basically, one can show that if the map from the group to the matrices is a homomorphism, the map from the group to these bigger matrices is also a homomorphism. And there is a little bit one needs to show that it really is. I mean, it's not hard. It's an exercise in using linearity. Right. So that is a tensor product as far as we are concerned here. We don't need the universal property, or or constructing it as a quotient of the free module or something. It is simply a way to combine two smaller dimensional modules to a module whose dimension is the product. Okay. Right. So, going back to Aschbacher's theorem, here I had things which corresponded to a decomposition of a vector space as a direct sum of submodules. I could have the same thing, both cases analogs, corresponding to a decomposition as a tensor product and not as a direct sum. So I will get two cases which look in some way rather similar. Okay. For reasons which are beyond my control, these are not cases 3 and 4, but the numbering is slightly different. So this is case 4 and case 7. Okay. As I said, this paper is not winning an award for lucid description. It's just here, I think, since everyone, with the Onan Scott theorem, there were so many different versions that I felt comfortable with saying, okay, then I don't go with either of them. Here, everyone seems to be using that numbering, and so I'm sticking with the numbering as it was there. So, I could have that M is a tensor product of submodules. Why submodules? Obviously, in the tensor product structure, if I choose the vectors of the form AI tensor B1, I get a submodule. And on that submodule, not B1. What do I want to do? I want to take. Do I want submodules? No, it's a tensor product, just let's say of modules. No, I don't necessarily have submodules. I can get a homomorphism and get factor modules, but I could have the situation that I can consider this module as a tensor of modules. So what it would say for the group is, in a suitable basis, choice of basis, all the matrices have this structure, this block structure, but it's unfortunately not with zeros, but just with certain scaling properties, and that's rather complicated to describe with matrices. Okay. Right. That would correspond to reducible, and what I can do is, and that is class 7, I could have a tensor product. Here I actually have non-isomorphic modules. If I have isomorphic modules, what I can also allow is not just a tensor product decomposition, but I can allow myself to permute the submodules amongst each other. So M is equal to V1 tensor V2 tensor tensor VK, and none of the VIs is invariant, so this is again as vector space, and G permutes the VIs. So the structure I would be getting is basically that I don't just have this structure, but now allow block permutation matrices which permute these blocks amongst each other. And that's a little bit too complicated to write down in matrix form. Okay, So these are the next two classes. And again, I mean, this is not some, don't worry about memorizing these things. This is more just something to be aware, okay, there is such a list. And if I really need at some point, if I need to go and describe maximal subgroups of the special linear group, I can go to this theorem and then pull out a list. Okay. So, what's the next case? The next two cases basically have to do with choice of the field. So, well, let's say you have a group which acts, you take a subgroup of GL 3 over the field with 25 elements. You could, by choosing a basis for the field with 25 elements, you could write that group in dimension, since it's two-dimensional vector space, in dimension 2 times 3, so you could write it in dimension 6 over the field with 5 elements. Okay. And that is a typical exercise in Galois theory when you look at field extensions, just to say, yes, one could do this. So you could write a matrix group over, well, it could, you could write it over a smaller field, and what will happen is, in this case, you can always do this, and your dimension grows with a dimension by a factor, which is dimension of the field extension. You could, if you have complex matrices, you could write them over the real numbers in twice the dimension. Equivalent matrices, by just keeping real and complex parts. Okay, so I could have such subgroups, and that's basically Aschbacher's theorem wants to look at it in the sense of a reduction. So here, reductions would be, say, to the groups on the submodules or the permuting action on the submodules and the action on the stabilizers of the submodules. So what could happen is that basically this field extension structure is preserved. So, and that is class C3. Well, up to scalars. What do I mean by up to scalars? I'm looking not at the full GL, or the full SL, but I'm really looking at subgroups which contain the center. The center are scalar matrices. What could happen is that the maximal subgroup I have somehow wouldn't fit perfectly in this case, but I can decorate it a bit by adding scalars. And these scalars, if they are over, these scalars might not fit nicely with the structure of the larger field. So this is basically saying, if you go to PSL, if you don't go in the matrix world, or if you allow yourself corrections with scalars, then we can write G in smaller dimension over a larger field. Okay, so that would mean naturally this group shouldn't really live in GL6-5, but it really comes from GL3-25 and is just blown up in that sense. And of course you can describe all of these groups. What is the maximal one? The maximal one would be GL3-5 as a subgroup of such that GL325 is a subgroup of GL65. Okay. There is a dual of this, and this is class 5. Yeah. Don't ask me how he got to that numbering. It's probably also probably consistent with a stream of consciousness description. Oh, yes, that could also happen. So, there is what could happen is also that we have a subgroup of GL, well, even GL325, which already lies in GL35. GL35 is a subgroup of GL325. And what you can do is, if you have such a subgroup, you can do a base change to just mix it up. That after the base change, the entries don't lie in the smaller field. Well, that would be is one kind of reduction. And again, we get this up to scalars, G lies in, G can be, up to scalars and up to base change, G can be written over a smaller field. With these various classes, I think here you can very easily write down a group in this form, right? You just take two groups and you form such. You take two GLs and you form all the block matrices. Here, you need to take GLs on the smaller spaces and block permutation matrices. Here, the tensor product, you take the GLs and you form these Kronecker products. Here, you need to take these, and in addition, you need to have matrices. These are not block permutation matrices. These are matrices which actually they need to swap the role of C and D. So they're rather messy, but they are still some kind of permutation matrices, but basically they need to revert the block structure. It's a bit messy to write down. Here you can write down, you can easily construct such a group, right? You just take GL325 as a subgroup of GL65. Here you just take GL35 as a subgroup of GL325. The other way around, identifying in which class, if someone comes with a group, identifying in which class you are isn't always easy. That is complicated. And the theorem doesn't say anything about it. It just says it falls in these cases. Okay. Then there is one class which I'll basically just skim over because that is rather complicated to describe. G normalizes a group which is called an extra special P group. And if that case is happening, yeah, there one would need to look more, but that would take rather long to describe as this case. Okay, and finally, last class, CA. And that is in some way actually the one which might look most geometric. There is one thing we haven't yet done. We have looked at decompositions of substructures. There is another thing you can do geometric, namely you can have inner products. And then you go from the general linear group, you can go to symplectic groups or unitary groups or orthogonal groups. And these tend to be maximal, and that's the last possible case. So G preserves a linear, bilinear, or a quadratic form. Okay. Let me briefly say what do I mean by bilinear form or by quadratic form. You've all seen what an inner product on a vector space is. Basically, and in an undergraduate class, unfortunately, often they just define the standard inner product on R to the n. But in function spaces already, you probably have seen that you can have potentially quite a number of different inner products because they are defined as integrals and the integral limits are not clear from where to integrate. So, more generally, you can define inner products in a generic or something like an inner product in a generic sense. What you want is a map from vector space cross vector space to the field, which is linear in both components. And that is called a bilinear map or a bilinear form. For a scalar product or an inner product, there was a second condition that you wanted to be positive definite. We don't necessarily need this here. And if you've done physics, you've seen if you take the Lorentz metric in special relativity, that is an example of a not positive definite metric, of a not positive definite inner product. So this is a very natural thing to do. It's just for some reason the undergraduate linear algebra textbooks don't like to do this. They sometimes feel, oh, probably because they're written by an American physicist. They just take the standard inner product. So what is in how can you describe in general such a bilinear form? A bilinear form on F to the n is given by taking, if I have two vectors V and W, and let's say we consider them as row vectors. If you don't have row vectors, you need to transpose everything. How do I want to define this? I want to take the row vector V and I multiply it with some matrix A and I multiply it with W transpose. Right? So if I'm doing this, clearly I will get a field element. Because row vector times matrix gives me another row vector, and row vector times column vector gives me a field entry. So it is in some way this, like the standard inner product, it's just I'm putting a matrix in between here. The standard inner product has the identity matrix here. And the matrix keeps everything linear, so nothing gets destroyed there. If this matrix is symmetric, then this bilinear form is symmetric. If it is anti-symmetric, that if I transpose, it changes the sign, that form is alternating. And this matrix is called the Gram matrix for the bilinear form. Okay, and yeah, there are a couple. You can take the identity matrix, then you get the standard inner product, and you get what is called the orthogonal. What preserving that matrices are called orthogonal. You get an orthogonal group. You can pick a matrix which is basically corresponding, well, or you might ask, sorry, if you have field extensions, you might even allow here to get a Galois automorphism there. And if you do this, you get Hermitian matrices over the complex numbers are what, or you get what is called the unitary group over finite fields. And you can have, if your matrix is basically anti-diagonal with a sign change in the middle, you get something which is called the symplectic group. And that is something which is not necessarily positive, that is not positive definite again. But this gives you certain structure preserving groups. And
so G preserving this would be that G times B, then
if I apply G on both parts, I will get the same result. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And what is a quadratic form? For a quadratic, basically, if I have a bilinear form, I can associate that's the same as going from inner products to norms, right? I can have Q of V shall be defined simply as the inner product of V with V. And we typically, because it's, we don't have the complex, or we don't want to go in the algebraic closure, we don't take the square root. Okay, so that would be a quadratic form. And now, and you might have seen this in functional analysis, if you define a norm on a vector space, you can get back to the scalar product. You can see whether a norm comes from a scalar product. And there is something called the polarization identity. And there is a formula, which I don't remember by heart, which says if you know the norms, you can recalculate what the inner product is by taking the norms of certain vectors. Okay. However, that formula divides by 2. So if you are in characteristic 2, you can define certain quadratic forms which do not come from a bilinear form. And there you get certain other orthogonal groups. Okay. That's why this says a bilinear or a quadratic form. That is just for the field with 2 elements. Okay. Yeah, and then there is class C9 is the class of almost simple groups. So there is a tool which Aschbacher's theorem gives us, a tool which is far more complicated than in the permutation case, but which again would allow us, if we have an arbitrary matrix group and we want to make a statement about it, we could basically say either we get certain reductions here, and you can look at these reductions really as even making it smaller in some sense. Here it makes the dimension smaller, here it makes the field smaller. And in these cases, we would have constituents which are smaller from which we can compose the group. And in the end, what remains is the almost simple case where again we don't have any reduction available. So, yeah, and I mean, in all of these cases, don't feel you need to memorize these theorems. As far as this class is going, basically, we will not, or well, you might encounter Owen and Scott in one place or so very, very briefly, but these are not things which we'll encounter here again. The reason I covered it is more that if you're working with groups, in particular if you're working with general linear groups which come up in all kinds of case situations, someone might just in a paper say, oh, and now we're using Aschbacher's theorem to do a case distinction. That's what this theorem is. And it is, yeah, it's a bit like making sausage. The end product is nice, but the proof is rather a disaster, and you don't necessarily want to know how this is done. Right. Yeah, that is basically what I wanted to do in the first chapter of this class. And it, well, it might have run a bit, so the next chapters probably will be a bit shorter to fit it in. This is group actions and decomposing group actions into smaller parts. That's really the theme here. What I did not do is you can have many particular group actions, particular examples where nice and prominent groups come from by acting on particular structures. That is something which the groups which come out are nice and the effects which come out are nice, but that is getting is becoming a little bit like butterfly collecting. Yes, there are some nice things, but you can't necessarily generalize. It just happens in particular cases, and I think that is rather better looked at just in an ad hoc case. So what I want to do after to start with after the spring break is to look at what goes under the name of combinatorial group theory. This is looking at groups given by generators and relations. And that's how you've seen the first groups probably in your first algebra class after they gave you a group by a multiplication table. They say, oh, we have the dihedral group. It is generated by a rotation. That rotation has order 4 and a reflection S. Why S? Because in German, reflection is Spiegelung. And so you have an element S which has order 2, and then we observe that if we rotate, that is the same as the inverse rotation. So we have rotation, reflection is the same as reflection and then inverse rotation. And oh, isn't that nice? We can now bring every element into a form where we first have a reflection and then a rotation. And the rotation has, there we have 4 choices, say if we have a square, the reflection, and we have 2 choices, so our group has at most order 2 times 4, which is 8, and indeed it has order 8, and we can write down the elements. Okay. And in some way, that looks rather natural as a thing to describe groups. So people do this. What can one tell about these groups? Unfortunately, the structure very quickly becomes more complicated, and this normal form argument is really only applicable in very, very specific small examples or very nicely behaved examples. You can't do this in general. But these groups, these structures come up very, very natural in topology. Namely, if you want to have the fundamental group of some space. What you do is you make the space, you put a triangulation on the space. Well, if you can't do that, things get a bit more complicated. But let's assume you can do that. And you now basically choose as generators going from one triangle via a face to another. So you start with a triangle, you label the faces with ABC. And if you flip over the side, so if you have side A and you flip the triangle over side A, you get to another triangle. Well, not necessarily perfectly, but you have a correspondence. And that's how you can label the faces of this triangle. And so you just get, say, 3 generators, which correspond to from where do you go, what happens if you go over the edge of a triangle. And now you can ask, what happens sometimes you go back, right? You flip a couple of times and you come back to the original triangle. That gives you such relations. You can say, oh, if I do the A reflection, B reflection, A reflection, A reflection, C reflection, it's, no, you don't want the A reflection. If you do this in a while, well, you get back, you describe in all possible ways how this can happen. That describes your fundamental group. And people are interested in studying these groups and studying their structure. And what I want to do is to describe a little bit what these groups actually are and how one can work with them. Yeah, but not starting now. So yeah, have a nice spring break and I'll see you afterwards. Thank you.